Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. This is podcast number 52, and this is for Monday, November 21st, 2011. Almost said 2010. I have such trouble figuring out what year this is. The year's gone by so quick anyway, it's just crazy. The sound quality may not be so great on this podcast. We're, again, on the road. I'm actually in the motorhome. If you could hear that a second ago, that was Nikki the dog scratching her ear. That little jingling sound was her collar. So you're going to probably hear a lot of odd background noises like that. Maybe cars going by. Who knows, we might even get a train sound in on this one. There's a train tracks not very far from where we're parked at. So today's topic I wanted to cover, I found an article in Wikipedia called Criticisms of Socialism. And, you know, Wikipedia just amazes me. It's so bad on some things, but it's so good on some other things. And oftentimes what it's really bad on, you can go back later and find out that it's been corrected and it's really good. Or correct it yourself. So I wanted to read some of this article on criticisms of socialism in Wikipedia. My criticism of this article, Criticisms of Socialism, is that it's a little on the technical side for most people, for most readers. You have to have a little bit of a understanding of basic economics in order for some of the terminology to really come through and mean what the authors intend for it to mean. So that makes it a little clumsy to your average reader because, you know, economists use words in a slightly different way than what we might say regular people or normal people. So because of that, it gets kind of confusing. I've done an article before on rent-seeking. If you say the words rent-seeking to the average person, they're going to think you're talking about something to do with rent, strangely enough. But in fact, to an economist, rent-seeking has nothing to do with what we normally think of as rent. And so if you just do a search at badquaker.com in the search bar over on the right side, and just put in rent-seeking, and I've done articles on that before. Maybe I'll put a link in the notes for this show on badquaker.com. But that's just one example of where economists use a very common word or phrase that means it has a totally different meaning to the economist than it does to the average person. So as I go through this article on Wikipedia, there are a number of terminology, words and terminology that are strictly, that have one meaning to an economist. And either that meaning is veiled or it's a completely different meaning to the non-economist or someone who hasn't taken any economics classes or whatever. And let me just point out, I am to economics what I am to being a NFL quarterback. In other words, as an armchair quarterback, as the phrase goes, where the person sits back watching TV and criticizes some football player for not doing this or for doing that or whatever. In that sense, that's how much of an economist I am. I have taken zero actual classes. My only understanding of economics is that I have listened to hundreds of hours of lectures that are available to everybody at Mises.org, and I have read certain books like Man, Economy, and State, and Socialism by Mises, Man, Economy, and State by Rothbard, For New Liberty, a variety of, I don't have the right computer with me, otherwise I'd pop up my reading list and go through some. But that, what would be the purpose? It'd just be, you know, bragging anyway. I've read quite a few books on Austrian economics. And I've like I said, I've listened to hundreds of hours of lectures. But that no more makes me an economist than my experience watching the NFL makes me a quarterback. But what I do hope to do in this article is I hope to cover some of what's said here in Wikipedia in this article and maybe put it in terminology that might be a little bit more useful to the average person. So that was like 5 minutes of introduction to this article, and probably 4.5 minutes of that were unnecessary. Okay, so let's get into the article. I'm going to skip the first paragraph of the article because basically it just explains what the article is, and I think I kind of covered that already. This is Criticisms of Socialism in Wikipedia. Okay, it says, economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and some classical liberals view private enterprise, private ownership of the means of production, and the market exchange as a natural and or moral phenomena central to their conceptions of freedom and liberty. Contrawise, members of these three groups may perceive public ownership of the means of production, cooperatives, and state-sponsored economic planning as infringements on liberty. Now, that's a really good paragraph made up of only two sentences. I have no idea who the author is here, because it's Wikipedia. So let me just step back and read that again. Economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and some classical liberals. Now, these three groups, what it says, these three groups, actually, that's kind of the same. I mean, there may be some minor distinction between these people. But essentially, what it's calling economic liberals and classical liberals, this is confusing maybe to American audiences because in America, when we say liberal, we're referring essentially to socialists and sometimes even communists. Certainly progressives are considered liberal. And none of those people are who we're talking about here. When this says economic liberals and classical liberals, this is in the European sense. We're talking about those people who used to be called in the United States economic liberals or classical liberals. In the United States, we now refer to them as libertarians, or some of our critics refer to us as nuts or nutcases or crazies or wackos. But that's us. Libertarians are often thought of as being, in America, as, thought of as being conservative or right-wing, and that's not true at all. But we're also not left-wing and we're not liberal. We're neither right-wing or left-wing, and we're not a combination of the two. We're not a little bit right-wing and a little bit left-wing. Those are all false classifications. And I did an article on this called, I can't remember, but I'll put a link to it. It exposes the myth that libertarians are a little bit liberal and a little bit conservative. We're not. Libertarianism is a very consistent philosophy, and it is neither liberal nor conservative. But my point here is that the old label for libertarians was liberals. We're talking the 1800s. We were called liberals. And in Europe, many libertarians are still referred to as liberals. So that's totally different than what America calls a liberal. In America, the liberals are, socialists. The honest ones will admit that. The others display it in their actions. But then again, you know what? In America, the right wing, the conservatives, they're socialists too. They either aren't honest enough to admit it, or they aren't bright enough to admit it. It may seem a little harsh, but the truth is often harsh. Okay, so we get that out of the way. It says, economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and some classical liberals view private enterprise, private ownership of the means of production, and the market exchange as a natural and or moral phenomena central to their conceptions of freedom and liberty. I'll go a little further than that. It says pro-capitalist libertarians. I'm not sure how you can be a libertarian and not be pro-capitalist. That is, if you're using the word capitalist in its true sense and not the way the communists like to use it. The communists like to take fascism, call that capitalism, and then bash us with it. You see, when socialists or communists refer to capitalism, they're almost always referring to fascism. They're rarely, if ever, actually talking about real capitalism. So, and we have allowed them, we being capitalists and libertarians, have actually allowed them to distort these words. And really, when we do that, when we allow them to distort these words, we lose the argument before it even begins, because they've taken our terminology. So if I'm talking to a fisherman, we're standing next on a pier next to his boat, and I say, that's a very nice hat you have there, and I point to his boat, and he says, what are you talking about? I said, your hat. That's a nice hat. And he says, what are you talking about? That's a boat. That's not a hat. And if I insist that it's a hat, and I tell him, I'm an expert on hats, and that's a hat. Well, if he accepts that argument, that it is indeed a hat, then how can he then justify buying a boat, or owning a boat, or having a boat, or riding in a boat? You see? So when the socialists take our words, like capitalism, and distort them, and refer to fascism as capitalism, it's the same as just renaming something, a totally different thing that it's not. It, as a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. It's not like a boat and a hat. It's more like a boat and a rock, because rocks don't float. Well, typically they don't. There's that weird volcanic ash rock that floats, but not the point. Okay, so I would say economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and some classical liberals, that's really kind of the same thing. It's all under the classification of true capitalists, which are almost a necessity of being libertarians. And libertarians are almost of a necessity true capitalists. Now, there are confused libertarians and there are confused capitalists. But we're talking about the pureness of the theory here. The pureness of the theory of a libertarian gives you no choice but to be a capitalist. And the pure theory of capitalist leaves you no other choice but to be a libertarian. And if you are not true to the pure theory of it, well, then the variation from that is socialism. Okay, so let's go back again. And I'll read this one. I'm just beating this line to death. I won't do this with the whole article, I promise. Economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and some classical liberals view private enterprise, private ownership of the means of production, and the market exchange as a natural and or moral phenomenon central to the conceptions of freedom and liberty. Okay, so we've established what economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and classical liberals are. Now we need to look at what is private enterprise, private ownership of the means of production, and the market exchange to see what it is that that's talking about. Well, actually, that's the same thing. Just like economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and some classical liberals are the same thing, private enterprise, private ownership of the means of production, and the market exchange are essentially the same thing. Now, again, just like the other terminologies, you can pollute them with socialism. But in the pureness of their theory, it's the same thing. You can't have a free market if part of that market is shackled by socialist rules or by the state. It's not free. That's like a bird in a cage is not a free bird. A bird in a bigger cage is still not a free bird. A bird in an even bigger cage is not free. If you take that bird, take him out of the cage, but put a leash on his leg like some falconers do, it's still not a free bird. If you clip its wings and let it hop around, it's not free. If you teach that bird that it always has to return to you like a falconer will do, so that the bird believes itself to be dependent upon its handler, then the bird is still not free. It's fooled, it's confused, but it's not free. It is still a slave of its master. Now, this is the case with the market. If the market is mostly free, it's not free. If the market has restrictions, emplaced on it by any authority that uses violence and aggression, then it's not a free market. You can't be a little bit free. You are either free or you are not free. Okay, so really, private enterprise, private ownership, that's the same thing. How can you have enterprise if you don't own something? How can you exchange something you don't own? So enterprise, ownership, and we're talking about the means of production. What is the means of production? Well, anything, labor, any goods, any services, any kind of exchange that takes place, all this is the means of production. If you if you're talking about raw materials like rocks or dirt or the ground or trees or, you know, anything like that that's raw material is the means of production. Refined material is the means of production. Labor is the means of production. Currencies of exchange, whether that's modern money, or I shouldn't say modern, but fiat money, as most central banks push, that's a means of production. You can't, that's without capital exchange, there is no means of production. So money is part of the means of production. Real money, such as hard currencies, gold, silver, or any other commodity-based form of exchange. If you were in a community that you, I've talked before about using corn as a means of exchange. If you were in a community that used corn, or I had one article where we talked about was it chiclets? No, not chiclets. I compared M&Ms and what are those called? Not Reese's Pieces. Oh, I can't remember the candy that I used. Anyway, I used in one comparison, I used types of candy. It could be a form of commodity money in a nursery setting. That was the point of that article. But it doesn't matter what form of money that's being used. Money is an aspect of the means of production, as is labor, as is the time that individuals can spend on things. All this together is the means of production. And if the state or any other non-individual, a community together shares the ownership of the means of production, or if a group of people control the means of production in any sense other than the individual, then it's not a free market. It's socialism. The only way that you can have a free market is if the means of production are privately held. That means you have to have property rights, you have to have private ownership, and you cannot have communal ownership of anything, and you cannot have coercion or aggression in the ownership of anything. So individuals can have, they can protect what they own. That's not aggression, but aggression where you're going to have self-defense. The difference between self-defense and aggression. Self-defense is defending not only yourself but your own property as well, and yourself is part of your own property. So, okay, so I just talked in a huge circle, but anyway, so my point in that is that private enterprise, private ownership of the means of production, and the market exchange are all the same thing. And if those are not in the hands of private individuals with private property being respected, then you do not have a market exchange. You do not have free enterprise. You do not have capitalism. What you have is socialism. And that's the basis of the philosophy of libertarianism. Okay, now the second line in that little two-line paragraph says, contrawise, members of these three groups that we already established was actually the same group. Contrawise, members of these three groups may perceive public ownership of the means of production, cooperatives, and state-sponsored economic planning as infringements on liberty. Again, that says a tremendous amount in one line, so let me just break that apart. Infringements upon liberty is what I was talking about a second ago. You can't have public ownership of the means of production, cooperatives owning the means of production, or state-sponsored economic planning, or state-sponsored ownership, or state ownership of the means of production. You can't have those and still be free. It's back to the bird with the bigger cage thing. If I can't own and control all of my private property, then I'm not free. I don't have I'm not in a state of liberty. I am in one way or another bound. I am burdened with slavery to one extent or another. So now there is distinction in this line between what they're calling public ownership of the means of production, cooperatives, and state-sponsored economic planning. Okay, state-sponsored means the state controls it through aggression. Or, you know, lies and deception and theft and the things that the state actually does. On the other hand, you can't have public ownership of the means of production unless you have one of two things. It's either a voluntary association of a large group of people. Well, that would make it a cooperative because they cooperate. Or it is not voluntary. Therefore, it is a state. If there is aggression being used to control the means of production, then it's a state. If it's voluntary, then it's a cooperative. Now, I'm not going to attack voluntary or cooperative socialism in this article today, because the theories are so vastly different between voluntary socialism or cooperative socialism and state-sponsored socialism. There are a lot of anarchists. I would go so far as to say most people who call themselves anarchists are actually socialists who believe in a voluntary or cooperative version of socialism. And this is so so vastly different than state-sponsored or the state-enforced socialism that they really have to be dealt with on two different levels. So in this article, I'm not going to be addressing in any way voluntary or anarcho-socialism. That's a totally different argument. Okay, so that all that discussion on just those two lines that made up this this paragraph. And I don't mean to just beat this horse, to beat a dead horse, but I want to read this paragraph again so that you can, so I can just recap it and you can see what I'm talking about. Economic liberals, pro-capitalist libertarians, and some classical liberals view private enterprise, private ownership of the means of production, and the market exchange as a natural and or moral phenomena central to their conceptions of freedom and liberty. Contrawise, members of these three groups may perceive public ownership of the means of production, cooperatives, and state-sponsored economic planning as infringements on liberty. Okay, so the next paragraph goes, critics from the neoclassical school of economics criticize socialist theories that promote state ownership and or centralization of capital on the grounds that there's a lack of incentive in the state institutions to act on information as effectively as managers in capitalist firms do because they lack a hard budget constraint, profit and loss mechanism, resulting in reduced overall economic welfare for society. Critics from the Austrian School of Economics, that's us, argue that socialist systems based on economic planning are unfeasible because they lack the information to perform economic calculation in the first place due to the lack of price signals and a free price system, which they believe are required for rational economic calculation. Critics of the socialist political movement often criticize the internal conflicts of the socialist movement as creating a sort of responsibility void. Now, on that responsibility void, I've made this argument before in articles that what socialism and the state itself do is they create an opportunity for individuals to skirt their natural responsibilities, the responsibility for their own actions disappears because the state becomes responsible. It's the state's fault. I was obeying orders, or I'm just doing, I'm obeying the law, or I'm, you know, all whatever the bad thing is that you do, you can blame it on the state and say, well, I'm doing this because it's because the state is making me do this, or because this is what I'm supposed to do, or because this is the law, or this is my orders. So we justify theft by use of the state. I want a park to walk my dog in, so I'm willing to use the force of the state to tax my neighbors to provide me with a park so I can walk my dog. You see, that's theft and aggression. I'm stealing from my neighbors so that I can have a park to walk my dog in. I want the state to pay for my education. Or I want the state to pay for my children's education. What does that mean? That means I want the state to use a gun and stick it in the face of little old ladies and old men who are already retired and have no children and are not getting an education. I want the state to shove a gun in their face and take their taxes and pay for my children's education. See how that translates when you actually speak the truth and you say it differently, but you say it truthfully. It doesn't quite have the same impact. Oh, we should have, the state should provide roads. What that means is, I want people to pay for the roads that I want to drive on. I want other people to pay for those roads. I want the state to go to those people and rob them and take their money and build the roads that I want and maintain the roads that I want. I don't care, as I sit here in southwestern Missouri, I don't care if the highway projects go through in Boston or in New York or in Los Angeles or in Alaska. None of those highway projects affect me in the least. What I want is the road that I'm driving on today to be paved well. And I'm willing to rob people in New York and in Kansas City and in Iowa so that I can have a good road here in Missouri, you see? I'm willing to rob a little old lady who's living on a fixed income in some old folks home somewhere. I'm willing to have the government shove a gun in her face and rob her so that they can fix the potholes in the highway that I'm driving on today. You see how that sounds differently? Well, that's the difference between a free market where people voluntarily choose to spend their money or to put their capital in whatever way they want, or a socialist economy where central planners or the government, the state, in one form or another, uses aggression and violence and threats and deception in order to accomplish what some people decide is the most important. Okay, so let's get back to our line here. All of that, what I was just talking about, is summed up in this paragraph under the what it refers to as a responsibility void. The state, using socialism, allows people not to be responsible for their own actions, and the responsibility for their actions is placed back on the state. Thus, we can round up 6 million Jews and murder them, and we can just say, well, we didn't do that. The government did that, see? In the case that I'm picking on the Germans there, let's pick on the United States. We can round up all of the people of Japanese descent and shove them into concentration camps. And we can say, oh, no, but it's for the protection of the state. It's because the state did this. It's not, I didn't do this. I didn't round up these Japanese people. I didn't destroy their businesses and steal their property. The state did that, you see? No. You tolerated the state. You robbed those people of their businesses and their private property, and you shoved them into a concentration camp. You treated them like animals. And how close did America come to exterminating them? I don't know. I don't know what it would have taken for America to take the next logical step and exterminate the Japanese in the 1940s. The way that the Germans were exterminating Jews and Gypsies and some Christians. I don't know what it would have taken. Would it have taken another Pearl Harbor? Is that all it would have taken? And the United States would have, the United States government would have begun exterminating the people that it had rounded up and held in camps? I don't know. But that's what socialism brings. It brings the opportunity to take the responsibility for your own actions and spread them out over a vague non-human entity, the state. And so you don't have to be responsible for what you've done. Okay, let's get back to this article again. Some confusing words were used in that paragraph. Critics from the neoclassical school of economics criticize socialist theories that promote state ownership and or centralization of capital on the grounds that there is a lack of incentive in the state institutions to act on information as efficiently as managers and capitalist firms do because they lack a hard budget constraint, profit and loss mechanism, resulting in reduced overall economic welfare for society. Okay, so in other words, the reason why socialism won't work, the flaw in socialism is what it refers to here is the profit loss mechanism, or it's the same thing as the price mechanism. I refer to it when I talk about the state as a reward punishment system. Humans have a natural reward punishment system, and when I say punishment, I don't mean beating children. That's not what I'm talking about. But everything we do in life provides us with a reward or a punishment. If I'm hungry and I eat nothing but candy, there's a punishment for that when my teeth rot out, you see. If I'm hungry and I do nothing but shove McDonald's hamburgers down my throat constantly, there's a punishment for that in the fact that I'll probably die a lot younger than if I'd eaten some salads now and then. So there's a profit and loss. There's a winning and a losing in all natural settings and in all of human experience. And that is eliminated when you bring the state and or socialism, because remember, the state is socialism. The state cannot function without socialism. So when you bring socialism into the mix, you remove that reward-punishment aspect, and you introduce the vagueness of no punishment for your individual actions. So when we're talking about the price mechanism, or whether we're talking about the profit and loss mechanism, or whether we're talking about what I refer to as the punishment reward system, it's the same thing. It's the price mechanism is individual choices that people make to say, Murray Rothbard was that Man, Economy, and State? I think it was Man, Economy, and State, where he goes on for about 9,000 chapters talking about horses and barrels of fish, barrels of dried fish. Anyway, it's a great book if you can get through it, but there's just this long section where he refers over and over and over to horses and barrels of dried fish, and his point is that let's say you're using horses to plow a field with, and you need a horse so that you can plow your field. So that horse is very important to you. It has, in your mind, it has a certain price that you're willing to pay, and that price will be very high because you have to plow this field. So in your mind, the price of a horse, you're willing to pay a lot for a horse. But now, so you buy a horse, and now along comes another, a man with another horse, and he says, would you like to buy another horse? And you think in your mind, two horses would be better than one horse. I don't absolutely have to have that horse, but yeah, that would be nice to have a second horse to plow this field with. But you're not willing to pay as much as you did for the first horse, because the first horse is more important to you. You can't plow the field without one horse. You can plow it with only one, but it'd be nice to have two. So you're willing to buy a second horse. But you're not willing to pay the same amount for it, because the second horse is not as valuable to you as the first horse. But to somebody else who doesn't have a horse, but they have the field and they have the money, that horse is worth a lot to them, more than to you maybe. So let's say you buy that horse. Now you've got two horses to plow your field with. You're doing great. You've got a team. And so you're out there plowing your field with two horses, and a guy comes up with another horse. Now, he says, hey, you want to buy a horse? Well, you might buy a horse. You might or you might not. It's according if the price is right. You see, the price is what you're willing to pay. And once you've already got two horses to plow your field with, the price of a third horse, you don't need it so much. So you're not willing to pay what you would pay for the first or the second horse. You might think it might be good to have a third horse as a backup, or you might be so talented that you can handle a team of three horses. So you might buy the third horse, but you're not going to pay for it what you paid for the first one or the second one. On the other hand, another man, as I said a minute ago, who has no horses, to have that horse, he might be willing to pay a lot more than you would pay for it. Or maybe there's another man who has no field at all, and his only interest in horses is because he likes the beauty of the horse and he likes to watch the horse run across the field. Well, each of these different people in each of these different settings places a different value on that same horse. And even the one person places a different value on the one horse, considering what he already owns, whether he has a horse or not. So by the time you get to the 10th horse, you only need two to plow your field. And you've already purchased nine, and somebody shows up with a 10th horse. What's the value of a 10th horse to you? Maybe none at all. Maybe you're like, I don't want any more horses. I have more horses now than I can feed. So perhaps the 10th horse would have no value at all to you. And yet the first horse was critical to you, you see? So this is how the price mechanism works. And this is why central planning can't work, because no central planner can get into every single individual's mind and figure out what every individual is willing to pay for each different thing. Only the business person, only the buyer and the seller can figure out what that price mechanism is. No central planner can efficiently or honestly figure out that price mechanism, and that's why socialism won't work. Okay, back to the article again. Okay, the line that I was at is, critics from the Austrian School of Economics argue that socialist systems based on economic planning are unfeasible because they lack the information to perform economic calculation in the first place due to the lack of price signals and a free price system, which they believe are required for rational economic calculation. Okay, that's what I'm talking about with the horses. See, now I'm as bad as Murray Rothbard. Murray just took forever to explain about the horses and the barrels of fish. And here I am talking about the horses for, 10 minutes here? Well, that's what I'm talking about, though. No one can get into the guy's head, the farmer's head, and figure out what he's willing to pay and figure out what the price of each additional horse is. Only that farmer can figure that out. And additionally, the seller of the horses, if he only has one horse, he's going to want a different price for that one horse than if he's selling, if he's got 300 horses and he's wanting to sell one. So this balance between the buyer and the seller cannot be figured out by any third party, and especially not a third party utilizing aggression. Because there is no mechanism for the third party to figure out all of the complex intricacies of how each of these two individuals who are buying and selling make their decisions. There's no way a third party can understand this. I referred to, in a different article, I referred to a fire ravages through, destroys your home. And in the process, the fire destroys a picture, a cherished picture of your grandmother. It's your only picture of your grandmother. And you, now, once you've lost that precious picture of your grandmother, it's gone. And you can't, there are no copies. You can't get it back. And it was the one and only picture you had of your grandmother. Now, an insurance agent can come up and he can write you a check for what he decides the value of your loss is. But that insurance agent can never, never, never calculate what you lost when you lost that picture of that loved one. Because only you know deep inside the value of the picture. No person can get inside your head and assume that value. And therefore, only you know the price so to speak, even though you couldn't put the price of that picture in a dollar amount or in a monetary form. But whatever the value of that picture is in your mind, no one else can come up with that value. Only you know that value. Okay, so back to the article again. Critics of the socialist political movement often criticize the internal conflicts of the socialist movement as creating a sort of responsibility void. Okay, we covered that already, so I'm not going to beat that dead horse. Besides, who'd know what the value of a dead horse is anyway? Haha. Okay, so now our next paragraph. The criticisms presented below... Okay, well, hold on. I'm not going to read that because that's in reference to several other criticisms that are in the article. What I am going to do is I'll just jump down to the part where it says distorted or absent price signals. And this is right on the same theme that I wanted to touch on here. The economic calculation problem is a criticism of socialist economics, or more precisely, central economic planning. It was first proposed by Ludwig von Mises in 1920 and later expounded upon by Friedrich Hayek. The problem referred to is that of how to distribute resources rationally in an economy. The free market solution is the price mechanism, whereas people individually have the ability to decide how a good should be distributed based on their willingness to give money for it. The price conveys embedded information about the abundance of resources as well as their desirability, which in turn allows, on the basis of individual consensual decisions, corrections that prevent shortages and surpluses. Mises and Hayek argued that this is the only possible solution, and without the information provided by market prices, socialism lacks a method to rationally allocate resources. That's perfect. I hate to take that apart because that is perfect. The only trick is that there are words used in there that maybe to the non-economist might get a little confusing. When it's talking about corrections that prevent shortages and surpluses, the criticism of socialism by Austrian economists is that socialism will always produce gluts and shortages because there's nothing to tell the socialist, there's nothing to tell the central planner how much of something is needed and how much is not needed. So, for example, the classic example in the Soviet Union was nails. The Soviet economic planners, the central planners, could not figure out how many nails the market needed. So, not knowing how many nails the market needed, they couldn't instruct the manufacturers in the Soviet Union on how many nails to produce. So, well, they could instruct them, but they couldn't instruct them in a logical fashion because there was no price mechanism. The price mechanism is what lets the whole market, the whole chain reaction throughout the market know what is needed more of and what is needed less of. So in the case of nails, the central planners would say, okay, we need, 300 tons of nails. But the manufacturer would say, what size nails do you need? Well, the central planners were then confused because they didn't know how much of each different size of nails were required. So as the confusion took place, there would be gluts of one size of nails and shortages of other sizes of nails. So then the central planners would try to correct that through forcing the manufacturers to produce more of a different size of nails. And so there was this trade-off, and there was always, the central planners could never come up with the right amount because there was no price mechanism to tell them what was needed in the market. So you had gluts of one size of nails and shortages of other size of nails. And this produced a situation where housing couldn't be produced because they had all kinds of finishing nails and no heavy construction nails. Or at the same time, they had an abundance of spike-sized nails and no finishing nails. So that was the problem in the Soviet Union, that is the classic example of why socialism can't work. Now, if we take this to something, let's say, let's jump on the Tea Party people again, and the what I've been beating up the Greenbackers for quite a bit in the last few months. A lot of the people in the Tea Party movement have caught on to the old. This old hoax that the Greenbackers pull, that, oh, well, the Constitution says that the Congress should control the money supply, or they'll use different terminology in different ways. And they essentially want Congress to have, they want to eliminate the Federal Reserve, which is a good idea. The Federal Reserve is just a bunch of crooks. But they want to eliminate the Federal Reserve and put the Treasury Department in control of, they want to put Congress in control of the Treasury Department and have Congress decide how much money to print, and then the Treasury Department issue that money, so that it would be, in their theory that they push is that this would be constitutional. Of course, it's not constitutional. The Constitution talks about coining money, not printing fiat money. It's a totally different thing, and the writers of the Constitution understood that. So the Greenbackers are lying, or they're deceived when they talk about their process being constitutional. It is not constitutional, and unfortunately, a lot of people in the Tea Party movement have bought this very simple lie, and they're confused by it, and they don't know any better. But what you have when you have Congress controlling the money supply, and most specifically a fiat money supply, but anytime anyone in government controls the money supply, that's socialism. That's what socialism is. The money supply is an aspect of the means of production. As a matter of fact, it's the most important aspect of the means of production. And whoever controls the money supply controls the market. That's central planning in its most extreme. So anytime somebody, some Tea Party person or some so-called conservative or some so-called libertarian tries to tell you that Congress needs to control the money supply, realize you're talking to a socialist, whether they know it or not. Because control of the money supply is the prime aspect of socialism. So who is supposed to control the money supply? I'm supposed to control my money supply, and you're supposed to control your money supply, and the guy across the street's supposed to control his money supply. The market itself, all of us together. That's what free market is. If we don't control the money supply, if the free market is not in control of the money supply, then it's socialism. It's that plain and simple. And it's no different. This price mechanism that I'm talking about works exactly the same whether you're talking about barrels of fish, or you're talking about horses, or if you're talking about nails, or if you're talking about money. It doesn't matter what the commodity is. It doesn't matter what the which means of production you're talking about. If the means of production is centrally controlled, it's socialism. If it's in the market's hands, then it's free market. It's not confusing. What's confusing is all these terminology and words that they use, that the economists use to throw everything off. If there was a way to state this in more user-friendly terms, it might be easier for everybody to understand. Unfortunately, the economists get into this, fall into this trap of, you know, they want to be honest. Now we're talking about Austrian economists. We're not talking about Keynesians or Chicago School of Economics, because what they do for a living is deceive people. Chicago economics and Keynesian economics are both socialism, and their whole purpose is to deceive people and rob them and put that money in the hands of the government. That's their whole purpose of those two schools of economic thought. So Austrian economics is the only honest economics. And unfortunately, Austrian economists choose to use a language that the rest of us don't speak, and that is this economist talk. So it becomes very confusing. Okay, so let me finish off this article here. Actually, I'm not going to finish the whole article, but I just wanted to get through some of it to get my point across. But I did want to read this last part. It says, the debate raged in the 1920s and 1930s, and that specific period of the debate has come to be known by economic historians as the socialist calculation debate. Now, the reason that this debate took place in the 1920s and the 1930s is because during that time frame, honest economists were trying to work this out and testing the fields of economics to see if what Mises and others were saying was valid, or to see if what the socialists were saying was valid. And by the end of the 1930s, it became abundantly clear that Mises and the Austrians were right and the socialists were wrong. And so the socialists just simply stopped arguing. They stopped seeking the truth, and they just decided, well, we'll just use the force of government and do it anyway, because the socialists were totally in control of all the governments of the world by that time. By the end of the 1930s, the state had pretty much come to its maturity, and all the world was in control of the fist of the state. And so there was really no reason for the socialists to debate the free market economists anymore. In a sense, the socialists won the debate through the force of the state. And since the logical position, if you follow it through to its ultimate end, the logical position of the Austrian economist is anarchism. Now, some will argue that, but I'm not going to, because I said the logical end, if you follow Austrian economics to its logical end, which Murray Rothbard did and explains this quite well, then you have anarchism, true anarchism, which is the opposite of the state. And so since by the end of the 1930s, the state was totally in control everywhere, there was no reason for those who supported the state to debate the Austrians any longer. So it was easier just to ignore them, pretend they weren't there, and go on using the force of the state, the gun of the state, to inflict whatever they wanted. And that was the end of the debate. But the problem lies in the fact that socialism is still as inconsistent and as unstable as it ever was, and exactly the way Mises said that it would be. And therefore, at some point, the state will use up all of its resources, and the gluts and the shortages will become more and more obvious. This is the boom and the bust cycles that the Austrians talk about. These will become more rampant and more obvious, and eventually the state will devour itself, and it will collapse on itself and die. And so we just have to wait it out. Those of us on the free market side just have to wait and watch and separate ourselves from the state and not be a part of it when it dies, when it falls. Teach and push agorism as much as possible and show people how to have free trade underneath the radar of the state, black market, if you want to call it that, whatever it takes. And we will have freedom one way or the other. We will have liberty, because the state will fail and the state will die. Thanks a lot, folks, for listening. Be sure and check out badquaker.com. Get over there. There's all kinds of articles. There are over 100 audio articles of one form or another, podcasts, interviews, so forth. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.